Back together, you and I, to wrap up a big week, a busy week, Friday, October 22nd, 2021, on Connecticut Today. Some Friday fun with author Pat Pickens, a former sports editor at the Fairfield Citizen. He has a new book out, The Whalers, The Rise, Fall, and Enduring Mystique of New England's Second Greatest NHL Franchise. Attorney Mike O'Neill joined us again from the Landmark Legal Foundation to explain the controversy surrounding allegations that federal law enforcement agents are watching what happens at local school board meetings. Well, about 24 years ago, that song was in most ways silenced here in Connecticut. Of course, the song there, Brass Bonanza, the gold song of the then Hartford Whalers, who since, of course, over the past couple of decades, relocated. The franchise is still around. It now operates, of course, as the Carolina Hurricanes and has had some success, but when that franchise left Connecticut, it left a scar that for a lot of people has never healed. Yes, we have American Hockey League teams here, a WNBA team. We've had minor league baseball in and out, but that was the last time, and maybe in the foreseeable future, the only time Connecticut will be in one of the four major leagues. New book out, The Whalers, The Rise, Fall, and the Enduring Mystique of New England's Second Greatest NHL Franchise. Our guest has covered hockey for years, freelance writer, NHL, New York Times, Rogers Sportsnet, the AP, and from 2008 to 2013, he was sports editor at the Fairfield Citizen. We welcome to Connecticut Today on WICC. Pat Pickens is the guest. Hey, Pat, Paul here. How are you?
Hi, Paul. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks, Pat. Boy, I tell you, Pat, when the Whalers left, it opened a wound, Pat, that for a lot of people just has never healed, has it? I mean, the merchandise is out there. People can crank Brass Bonanza all they want on their computers. But you look back on it, and a lot of people wonder, was that it for major league sports in the state? It's been tough for people, hasn't it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's fascinating because when you talk, obviously, you know, the history of the Whalers is pretty it's pretty unique because, you know, they started WHA, they went to the NHL in 1979. They were, you know, sort of this also-ran franchise for a while. Then they had a run of success through the Emil Francis era, and then they sort of closed their chapter, you know, missing the playoffs the last five seasons. But, and it's funny because I'm not sure how many people up in Connecticut perceive that you're right. Some of them sort of moved on with their lives, but there is this sort of small but robust fan base that still continues to support the team. They, you know, they are part of the still active booster club. And I think that's sort of the fascinating tale of the team is, you know, sort of the team that won't die type situation because there's fans. You mentioned the merchandise, you mentioned Brass Bonanza, which continues to live on. Not just in Hartford, but also, you know, around New England. I think all the university pep bands play the song as part of their you know, musical repertoires. So, and yes, you know, there were hearts broken, you know, tears shed. And Kevin Dineen spoke about that, about, you know, a lot of the people. He was, you know, the last captain of the team when the team moved to Carolina. And he gave a speech after the final game, April 13th, 1997. And he said, you know, his neighbors, his friends, you know, people who his kids had grown up with, had you know, they were people there who he, you know, that was what sort of the unique part of the Whalers. They were part of the community. The team was part of the community, and the community embraced them. So you know, certainly they left because the fan support had dwindled to some degree. But yes, there was definitely a tale of broken hearts and tears shed along the way.
Pat Pickens is the guest. Hey, Pat, hang on. Got to do a quick check, traffic and weather together. Right back with Pat Pickens as we talk about the enduring legacy here on a Friday of the Hartford Whalers. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And undoubtedly, some folks in Norwalk, Fairfield County, Bridgeport area, Hartford, New Haven, everybody around the state used to make that drive down 84, up 91, down 91 for about 24 years. to see the Hartford Whalers before they moved out of Connecticut, now the Carolina Hurricanes. So the franchise is still alive, but the new book is called The Whalers, The Rise, Fall, and Enduring Mystique of New England's Second Greatest NHL Franchise. Pat Pickens, a former sports editor of the Fairfield Citizen, is with us. He has written the book. You know, Pat, being the hockey nut that I have been all my life, 1979, the World Hockey Association folds, and I get up one morning, and I'm 18 years old, and I see them are 17 the year before, and I say to myself, the Hartford's going to be in the National Hockey League? I'm like, what? And only a couple of years ago, we had Hartford referred to during the Patriots debacle coming here as, you know, America's filing cabinet. was there any consternation in the league, Pat, that the NHL had decided to take Hartford in or not?
I think there was some consternation across the league. And I think the book touches on it because you look at the story of the WHA merger was pretty fascinating in the first place because you had three Canadian teams in Hartford, and there were definitely some competing factions. There were people who really, the Bruins really wanted no interest, had no interest in sharing New England. You look at some of the Montreal Canadiens had no interest in sharing Quebec, and other Canadian teams had no interest in sharing sharing the Hockey Night in Canada revenue north of the border. So there was definitely some pushback north of the border. The Toronto Maple Leafs were vocally outspoken, famous owner Howard Ballard, who notoriously stingy and notoriously wanted to, trying to keep the Hockey Night in Canada revenue as one. I think there were only three teams in Canada at the time, and then the WHA merger made it six. And then they had to split the revenue from CBC that much. And there's stories of beer rivalries between Carling O'Keefe and Molson. Molson owned the Canadiens, and Carling O'Keefe owned the Quebec Nordiques. And the point you made, Hartford, Harry Sinden used to say Hartford was just any town USA. He didn't think of it as different from Providence or Albany or Bridgeport or any of the cities up in New England, the old mill towns up in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And yet Hartford had this place. You mentioned the industry was there, and they had Howard Baldwin was the owner and negotiated the terms of the merger. So of course he was going to get his team in. And and I think it's the WHA. There's a whole chapter about it in the book, and I think it's a fascinating tale. And it's really one that was it really is bizarre because we've heard about the AFL, and we know about the ABA, and the WHA was a league that was much like those as well.
I'm a lifelong Ranger fan, Pat Pickens, but I would go see the Whalers from time to time when I could. I came across tickets or went when the Rangers or Bruins were there. And Pat, aside from the X's and the O's and the scores, what I thought the Whalers did for Hartford and even for Connecticut, but really that great for Hartford area for a time, was generate life. I mean, on a game night, the garages would be full. The restaurants would be full. You went there early and you ate in one of the Civic Center restaurants. Chuck's Steakhouse was big back then. I mean, remember that? It would start filling up at 4 in the afternoon for a 7 o'clock game. And I walked out and I said, geez, this is great. I hope it can, be sustained. It didn't, obviously, but there's that economic impact of, some people poo-poo professional sports, Pat, but it does draw people into metros. It really does.
Without a doubt. And I think, Chuck Hayden and I talked about that, and we sort of I asked him straight up whether this was a story of, a failed team or, just unique economics. And he said it was economics, and I tend to agree. But you're right. I think, Howard Baldwin and I spoke. Howard Baldwin, obviously the founder and former managing general partner of the Whalers, started the team in Boston, moved them to Hartford, and then, through Springfield and oversaw the team till 1988. And he came back, and he had rebranded the American Hockey League team from the Hartford Wolfpack to the Connecticut Whale, in a sense, to try to lure the NHL back to Hartford. And he said that so much of the self-esteem of Hartford and in the region had really dissipated since he had left and then obviously come back because they watched – you mentioned the Patriots debacle – but they watched the Whalers leave, and a lot of the perception of the Whalers leaving was that, Governor Rowland and some of the folks in the government were more concerned with luring the Patriots to Hartford and try to get them a stadium. And obviously, Bob Kraft You know, the perception is he played Hartford like a fiddle to go back to Foxborough.
Mm-hmm.
But between Hartford, the Whalers leaving, and then Kraft jilting Hartford, that the region had lost a lot of its self-esteem. And you know, you look at some of the, you know, Hartford is not a vibrant downtown, particularly after 5 p.m. And there, you know, there's not a lot of reason for people to hang around down in the city after working hours. And even now with the pandemic, you know, people may not even make it into Hartford. But, you know, I think it's fascinating. And you said that, you know, in that mid to late 80s era, when the team was really hot and attendance was really good, really in the Emile Francis days, you know, Hartford was such a vibrant downtown. Mm-hmm. And people would talk about the excitement and going to games and how the insurance industry was booming. And there was just, you know, and then it just sort of tailed off from there.
Pat, hang on. We'll do one more segment. Pat Pickens is the guest, name of the book, The Whalers, The Rise, Fall, and Enduring Mystique of New England's second greatest NHL franchise. You know, the Bruins are on top. Traffic and weather together right here, 3:46 on WICC. And we spend a few more minutes here on a Friday. We tend to include some of the non-political stuff on Friday just to have some fun. We're talking about Hartford Whalers hockey here. The Whalers, The Rise, Fall, and Enduring Mystique of New England's second greatest NHL franchise. The author and guest, Pat Pickens. Pat also served as sports editor for the Fairfield Citizen from 2008 to 2013. You know, Pat, along with the games, there were those ancillary things that if you weren't at the game, the night that the Whalers were on, you kind of felt a little kinship across the state because, of course, you had, as you mentioned, the great Chuck Caton, who did play-by-play with Andre Lacroix, you know, two of the best broadcasters in the league, Rick Peckham on TV, along with, ironically, former Bruin Jerry Cheevers. Yeah, it was back in Sports Channel. It was back then when it was a big deal, Pat. Even if you weren't at the game, hundreds of thousands of people followed what was going on.
I'm glad you named Jerry Cheevers because he did the foreword. And I was so excited to get him for the book and to hear his tales of Hartford, because you mentioned, and he mentioned it, you know, he didn't know much about the Whalers when he came to Hartford to be the color commentator. And obviously the longtime Bruins goaltender, but it just sort of shared about how the market was so how it was really a sort of a familial relationship, it's sort of a community relationship between, because the team was community owned, was owned essentially by the city of Hartford, and how, like you said, you know, the people of that region were really, really into it. And it was a unique time because the Whalers' existence, you know, predated a lot of you know, sort of the modern technological advances we've seen. Obviously, they left in 97. It was sort of the rise of NHL center ice and satellite dishes was sort of coming of age. And the people of that region, you know, Boston was still 100 miles away, so it wasn't exactly super close to get out to a game. And you know, obviously there was Nesson, but, you know, back when the Whalers were coming around, if you wanted to see live hockey, you would have to drive out to it, or you would have to you know, you could watch it on Nesson, the games on Nesson, but it was sort of pre-cable. And like you said, you know, the Whalers were sort of the local team. So people would come out, that's sort of how they rose in terms of attendance. Especially in the early 80s, they outdrew the Bruins for a few years in their first couple of years. Obviously the Bruins were playing at Boston Garden and the Whalers were playing at the Civic Center. But I think, you know, there was really, like you said, a kinship to the team and in that region, because you know, you mentioned in the intro that there wasn't a pro sports team. There was obviously Boston, which was still 100 miles away, but there was, you know, UConn basketball certainly wasn't what it is now. And,
nope.
You know, there weren't too many other options in terms of, in the winter time, especially. So, you know, they really made, they sort of organically, you know, with the players being in the community, and then, you know, they did a lot of community work with hospitals and charity organizations, and they became a part of the fabric of the community. And then, like I said earlier, in the 80s, the insurance industry was booming, and the economy in Hartford was really good. And they talk about Whaler Mania and some of the real, you know, good teams, like legitimate. I said this, people almost don't believe it, but there were a couple teams that were legitimate Stanley Cup contending teams from Hartford.
Oh, yeah.
You know, bounce here or, you know, a break there, and who knows, you know, there probably would still be a team in Hartford.
Absolutely. Pat, finally, two things. I like how in the book you included the original mock-ups of the Whalers logo. I got to tell you that. The Whalers logo still, and I've talked to graphic design people who do this sort of stuff, they say it might be one of the top four or five, maybe 10 sports logos of all time. Everything that got into that logo, the H, the W, and the whale tail. And finally, Pat, the merchandise, probably because of that logo, it still sells like crazy. I've been on road trips doing hockey broadcasts, and I'm looking around town, and I see Whaler stuff. It's amazing.
Yeah. I think it's their the logo and certainly the color scheme as well that goes with it. They really were ahead of their time, and it's fascinating because Peter Good is the graphic designer who did it, and I got to speak with him a few times, and we're grown pretty close through the years here. And I think, he said he always talks about it engaging the mind, and like you said, with the H and the negative space and the color scheme and the whale tail and the W, obviously. But hockey people hated it. You know, Jack Kelly, who was running the organization at the time, hated it, and it was only because Howard Baldwin had the mindset that, you know, we want to be a little unique, we want to be a little kitschy, we have Brass Bonanza as our theme song. And I think you're right. I think that's what endures all these years later. Brian Burke came in and he changed. He didn't change the logo, but he added a gray accent.
Yes, he changed the color scheme to navy. He changed the colors, Pat, because I remember, and I interviewed him, I said, why did you change the colors? And he said, well, I think the blue makes us look bigger. He wasn't a big fan of the green, as I remember.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. He said he hated Brass Bonanza, and he thought the navy was more hockey versus the green. But it's fascinating because when Peter Cremano sold the majority stake of the Hurricanes to Tom Dundon in the fall of 2018, and I spoke with some of the people in Carolina, and they said this straight up. They said, you know, the Whalers brand was thriving. And, Howard Baldwin said that Whalers memorabilia was the 11th best-selling memorabilia of all NHL teams, and that was in 2011.
Wow.
And the NHL hadn't been there in 15 years. So, and then it's only gotten hotter since then. So the Hurricanes decided to start wearing the green jersey on the ice. They had Ron Francis as their general manager, and they decided that, you know, and they sort of tried to do it right in terms of their Whalers night. They were doing it as an homage, but also they were certainly doing it because of the brand recognition and how popular the merchandise is. And I've been speaking to college campuses over this week in sort of promotional and also sort of, you know, get the word out to some of the books. And I think there's kids who, you know, frankly, were not born when the team left.
Yeah.
You said it's been 24 and a half years, going on 25 years, and they have merchandise. You know, that's where the idea for this book even started, because I was the sports editor of the Fairfield Citizen. I would go cover high school hockey in the state playoffs as part of my beat really early on.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw those same, you know, high school students, you know, that were 15, 16. They were 4-3 and 4-5 when the team left, and they were wearing sweatshirts and hats and jerseys. And I couldn't believe it. I was dumbfounded by it because, you know, there was this team with modest success, you know, modest success to be generous in the NHL, and yet they have this brand and this logo and this color scheme that just endures and that people just can't get enough of. And it's fascinating. You know, the tale of this book has been fascinating. Like I said, it started in 2008. I did my first interview in 2011. And it just came out on Friday. It sold out in 3 days. There's more copies on Amazon now. So if you've heard about the book, if you've been shut out from buying it, there are some more copies on Amazon as of today. So you can get your orders in. But it's really been a fascinating ride. And to see the interest and the demand in Connecticut and really across New England has been really overwhelming.
Well, Pat, thank you and good luck. The Whalers, the rise, fall, and enduring mystique of New England's second greatest NHL franchise. Former sports editor, reporter for the Fairfield Citizen, Pat Pickens. Pat, thank you. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. The Whalers, the rise, fall, and enduring mystique of New England's second greatest NHL franchise. That's why mom and dad, grandma and grandpa, your kids are walking around with Hartford Whalers stuff on them. Okay, I'm confused because Congress is saying one thing, the Justice Department is saying another thing, the Attorney General is saying a third thing, and I have no idea what's going on. People have been calling me saying, hey, Paul, What is this thing about federal law enforcement keeping an eye on school board meetings when school boards get rowdy? You know, the parents may step out of line a little bit and being passionate over critical race theory. Isn't that what the local police are for? Shouldn't they just have a local cop there during the meeting and he can see what the situation is? Joining us right now, a gentleman we had on a few days ago, back to maybe parse this, see who's telling the truth and who isn't. Attorney Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation. Mike, it's Paul again here in Connecticut. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Paul. It's good to be back on.
Well, thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Well, can you explain to me what the heck is going on here?
Well, let's start at the beginning here. Well, so ostensibly the public beginning here. On September 29th, the National School Board Association sent a letter to President Biden making all kinds of ridiculous allegations and basically comparing these protests you're seeing at these, you know, individuals and citizens exercising their First Amendment rights, vehemently exercising their First Amendment rights and expressing their displeasure with the directions of these school that these school systems have gone. And they were making the allegation that this was akin to domestic terrorism. And within 5 days, which is extremely, extremely fast for the Justice Department to do anything. And in and of itself, that 5-day action is very questionable, thinking that this really originated on September 29th. Within 5 days, on October 4th, you had the Attorney General issue this memorandum where he directed federal law enforcement to collaborate with local law enforcement to determine whether individual parents expressing their First Amendment rights at these school board meetings is somehow violative of federal law. And the question here, we have two different levels here. We have the legal level, and then we have the public, the PR level, and mm-hmm. the leftist agenda level. Mm-hmm. First, let's talk about the legal level here. Legally, you're absolutely right, and your listeners are right. There is no federal hook here. There is no federal jurisdiction. The FBI does not have jurisdiction to police local county, local jurisdiction school board meetings. Again, this is a strictly local issue. The only possible federal hook that could come into it would be if somebody sent a letter, a parent sent an angry letter through the, you know, making some sort of specific identifiable threat to a school board member through the mail, and then maybe there would be some postal inspection jurisdiction there. But the FBI doesn't have any jurisdiction. Secondly, this isn't constitutional at all. This has the effect of chilling free speech, and that's exactly what it was intended to do. It was intended to chill the parents, the public's ability to express themselves in these school board meetings. If you're going to go to a school board meeting and you're going to quite rightly express concerns about the direction of your school board regarding CRT or gender ideology, you say, well, I might say something out of line. That memo has its effect. It has existed to chill your First Amendment rights. And actually, that, interestingly enough, could be a violation of the civil rights statute. Because you're seeing here an activity that's intended to suppress free speech, which is one of your most protected rights here, is something that could be offensive of our civil rights statutes. So interestingly enough, the Justice Department might have kind of, in doing this, violated its own the law, i.e. the civil rights statutes, by chilling our federal rights to free speech.
Interesting.
So
Mike,
that's illegal.
Yeah, Mike, hang on. I do have to take a break here. I want to come back because I have a bunch of questions here. Hang on. Mike
Absolutely.
O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation. What is up with a perceived threat from the Justice Department and the Attorney General Merrick Garland aimed at, you know, some parents who may get a little rowdy at school board meetings, but is this just over the top? Traffic and weather together, then back with Mike O'Neill coming up right here at 4:36 on WICC. Now, we know that, school board meetings tend to get a little rowdy these days, but is the federal government issuing a threat that supersedes its authority here? Mike O'Neill, attorney, one of the many fine attorneys from the Landmark Legal Foundation, joins us. Merrick Garland saying that, well, you know, they'll take a look and see if these are possible terroristic activities. Mike, listen, if I'm going to hold a school board meeting, I'm not saying it might not be a bad idea to have a school resource officer there to stay after late in the day, or to have one or two, you know, local police officers there just to maintain order. You never know what people do. But that's the point, isn't it, Mike? Local authority, not the feds swooping in here. If you want to have a local cop there, I don't see the problem.
Exactly. Local resources being used to handle local issues. There is no federal hook to this. The FBI has no business being in our school board meetings, trying to police us and to chill our rights to exercise free speech. And see, let's look at the, you know, I mentioned two things. I mentioned there's the legal aspects of this, in which I think is, again, really this memo really doesn't hold any kind of water from a legal or constitutional standpoint here. But then there's the public perception of this and the PR position and the leftist ability. And essentially what this is this is really part of a larger effort by the left to keep parents out of our classes and out of our school board meetings. If you can express yourself at a school board meeting, if you can direct the direction of the curriculum, you can help influence the direction of your child's curriculum. But as you see, the left doesn't want parents in the classroom. They want to keep us out so that they can use our classrooms to inculcate their radical agenda upon our children. And school boards will lie to parents. They will lie to the public. They will do whatever is necessary to protect these school systems and allow these schools and abet these school systems from pushing this leftist agenda on us. And when we go to express our opposition to this leftist agenda, what do? We are experienced with chilling free speech. We are experiencing threats from the federal government, threats from the FBI, that if we go there and exercise our First Amendment rights, we might be subject to some sort of penalty. And you really, where you can see this kind of all orchestrating and coming to ground zero, if you will, is Loudoun County here. And in Loudoun County, Virginia, which mm-hmm. has now become nationally yep. known, if yep. you see the school board has lied to parents, has done everything they could to keep parents out of the school board meetings, and quite frankly want to silence parents and want so that they can inculcate our children with their radical agenda. And they will stop at nothing. If that means using the full resources and power of the Justice Department, influencing trying to use their friends at the Justice Department and their friends in the White House to do this, they will do this. But parents should not rest on their laurels. Parents do not need to be quiet. Parents should rest assured that their right to express themselves, of course, peacefully. No one is saying that violence is ever the answer, mm-hmm. but expressing yourself peacefully and vehemently is the answer to ensuring that our children are protected and safe in schools.
Mike O'Neill, the guest from the Landmark Legal Foundation. Mike, I'm glad you mentioned Loudoun County, because I was going to mention Virginia. Boy, this really has become ground zero, not because of this alleged incident or incidents in Loudoun County with the bathrooms and everything, but in the Virginia governor's race, and mm-hmm. you know, a question and a debate between Glenn Youngkin and Terry McAuliffe about whether, you know, well, who should control what what a student learns, the schools, the parents, or a collaborative effort. And ever since Mr. McAuliffe kind of put his foot in his mouth on that, boy, this race has tightened up quite a bit.
Interestingly enough, once the curtain is pulled back, you actually see the true beliefs of the left. Whatever he is trying to say now is really short shrift, considering the truth came out when he said parents had no business in schools. That is the truth of the matter. That is what the left believes. When the curtain is pulled back, that's what we see. We understand that the left wants to keep parents out, and if parents are expressing themselves, then the left wants to chill those efforts for parents to express themselves and to direct and to have a voice in how our children are educated.
Mike O'Neill, thank you. Mike at the Landmark Legal Foundation. Check him out online, landmarklegal.org. Mark, thank you. Mike, rather, thank you. Have a great weekend. We'll check in down the road. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul. Have a nice day.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Mike O'Neill there, one of the many attorneys at, yes, a conservative organization. They make no bones about that, landmarklegal.org. But they also represent a lot of people on the left side of things who have constitutional issues. And in case you have not been following it, there is a governor's race going on, of course. Yeah, you may have heard that. Between Glenn Youngkin and Terry McAuliffe, who was the former governor of Virginia. Well, they were debating about a week or two ago. And the subject of critical race theory and teaching race and this and the other and racial history, whatever. And look, I don't think anybody's really against teaching history. But again, you can debate the CRT stuff. And up until that time, Terry McAuliffe had a pretty comfortable lead. You know, Virginia used to be really conservative. It's not anymore. In fact, it's trending very blue in most spots, where high-income people who work in D.C. want to get out of D.C. because of the crime, primarily. And they just want to go to Virginia, you know, live in a little more of a bucolic setting, and a question was asked among the two, and forgive me, I'm kind of paraphrasing now, but the question was asked, well, who should have say in what students learn? You know, should it be the parents only? Should it be the schools only? Or should it be a collaborative effort? Which is what I think. I don't think it should be one side completely or the other. I think it should be kind of a collaborative effort. You know, get a parents' council together, PTO, PTA, work with the schools, whatever. And as Mike said, Terry McAuliffe said something like parents have no business in the direction of the curriculum or no business determining that. Well, you talk about putting your foot in your mouth. It is amazing. It is amazing how politicians on both sides of the aisle will say the dumbest things. And when I heard Terry McAuliffe said that, I went, oh, my God, you actually said that. Now, I know what he's probably thinking. He's probably saying, well, we have experts here at what kids should learn. And, you know, listen, parents on both sides of the aisle can be a little dopey sometimes. I get that. I know that's probably what he was thinking. But you can't say it that way. You cannot say it that way. You can't say parents have no I'll pull up the exact quote here on the break. But you can't put your foot on the neck, as it were, of so many parents and not expect blowback. See, because what happens is when you answer a question like that, you may have some people that were kind of on the margin or on the line who were going to vote for you. Say, well, you know, at least I know what I'm getting here with McAuliffe. This Republican, I have no idea. Is he a Trump acolyte? Whatever. He says he isn't, but he may be. But I know McAuliffe from the Clinton years. And then McAuliffe says something dumb and you say, hey, wait a minute, Terry, you were never like this before. Are you now tracking to the left with all those dopes in the Democratic Party right now? So that's why, you know, you can say something. You don't. And debates are tough. Don't accuse me of sitting here and saying they're not tough. They're very tough. That's why the most effective debate prep that I've helped two or three people do over the years is you just ask them questions for like 7 or 8 hours at a time. And you ask them the most difficult questions that might not have any chance at all of being brought up, but you pound them. You pound them with questions for hours and hours and hours. It's like football. It's like basketball, baseball, or hockey. What do the best athletes say and the coaches say? Our practices are tough so the games won't be.